I'm here with Testament from Test Their Logic.
Yeah. What's up, Winnipeg?
He's doing a cross-country tour, but he's also been touring some of the revolutionary hotspots around the world, and we're going to have a conversation about his experiences in Egypt and a few other places.
Let's do it.
If you could, for the listener, detail the different strategies being taken by people in Egypt, contrasting the electoral strategy and the revolutionary strategy, and what's actually going on in the streets.
Right to the chase, eh? All right, so basically, I was just out in Egypt, hanging out mostly with anarchists and revolutionaries out there, not out there to, you know, monitor elections or anything. I guess, like, a lot of people have put some faith in the electoral system, but they haven't really put as much faith as they put in gathering in the streets. Gathering in the streets is still a pretty common thing that happens when people get enraged. There's like organizing. There's still a lot of those networks that were built around the original uprisings in a year ago, and so there's still ongoing clashes between people and the military, people and the police. And then there's a diverse way that people are kind of taking freedom right now. People are squatting. People are organizing independent unions. People are blocking parliament or cabinet, or they were when we arrived, and that actual occupation was quite literally crushed and burned to the ground, which resulted in 5 days of continuous 24-hour-a-day clashes in the streets. And so there's still a culture of rebellion that's ongoing, and a process of rebellion that's ongoing, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. I think people are in it for the long haul, and there are a lot of people who called the elections a total facade of change right from the start, and encouraged people to not vote. There was graffiti around town encouraging people to not vote, and people who, even people who did vote, it's not like that's seen as the revolution or the victory. That's just something that's happening right now, and as usual with representative democracies, those with money and power who can afford to pay for huge campaigns are the ones who end up getting into power. And so we have the Muslim Brotherhood, who had a lot of finances and had a lot of capacity to run a countrywide campaign, political campaign for political office, being voted in. And some of the people that voted them in probably voted them in just because they were, I guess, the furthest thing from the old politicians. You know, they were an outlawed group under Mubarak. But sadly, they have the same economic policies, and they have the same, they have a lot of the same social policies as the predecessors. So their so-called Freedom and Justice Party might disappoint a lot of the people that kind of elected them.
Can you describe how the uprising was kind of reborn again against the military after the eviction of the protests at Parliament, and kind of describe a day on the street during those protests?
Okay, so yeah, up until December, the majority of people in Egypt weren't super anti-military. I mean, the police are universally hated in Egypt. All cops are bastards is a very common tag, a graffiti tag on pretty much every wall in Cairo and across the country. And that hadn't spread to the military yet, because the military didn't use the same kind of violence against the people during the original uprisings. And there's also historical reasons why people feel affinity and respect for the military in Egypt. But post January 25, or post Mubarak stepping down, I should say, the army started to take more and more control over things. I mean, the army already had quite a huge stake in the nation's economy, has quite a huge presence politically, and then also in the media. The media, they have media companies, and they are also quite supported by the media establishment. And so They were pretty much extending this power and control to the point where they were just appointing people to the cabinet building appointing leaders, appointing people to positions of power, and they're holding on to power in a way that a lot of people started to see as being very undemocratic. And so a lot of people, even people who were interested in the election process, started becoming very critical of the military's grip on power. And what this led to was people actually started an occupation. They called it Occupy Cabinet. And they occupied the entrances to the cabinet building and actually were stopping the cabinet building from really operating, which is a really inspiring and amazing thing. As in terms of like a direct action against military rule and also against representation, representative democracy or whatever you want to call it. And so what happens is they held it down for a few weeks, and then in the middle of the night on December 15th, the military kidnapped one of the ultras that was at that occupation, tortured them, released them bloody and very obviously beaten. This angered people, and this led to some clashes, and then also led to the military just burning down the entire occupation to the ground. And so people eventually managed to push back the military. As more people started hearing about it, people showed up in the early hours. I mean, this happened at 3 a.m. And so then by like 6 a.m, people were starting to wake up and hear about what had happened and show up to support. And slowly but surely, more and more people would arrive and fight the military and push them back. And so the military were forced to retreat right into the building. And for the whole first day, the cabinet building was under siege, as the military were throwing rocks at people from the roof, and people were throwing rocks into the building and throwing Molotovs into the building, trying to light the cabinet building on fire. The military was on the rooftop and throwing chunks of marble down into the crowds indiscriminately, eventually even throwing Molotovs into the crowd indiscriminately. And then live rounds as well were used. And then it just kept going for 5 days straight. There was round the clock, 24 hours a day. There was a conflict. There was exchanges of projectiles. There was people that were shot by the military, and some pretty epic street fighting that resulted in them having to build several walls between Tahrir Square and the government buildings nearby.
How has the Muslim Brotherhood participated since the overthrow of Mubarak? Has it still participated in the uprising in a positive way, or has it become a reactionary force?
The Muslim Brotherhood has taken the line that we've won, or that the Egyptian people have won the revolution, and that now they should just accept democracy. And I mean, that's very convenient for them, since they were poised at the time to be the new leaders of the country. And so they didn't want to encourage people to continue rebelling. They wanted to encourage people to go through the so-called democratic process of voting in representatives. And now what this so-called democratic process really is a way for the revolution to be recuperated, and for the momentum that was gained, and for the things that people fought for and won taken back by the state. And so, you know, they're already made deals with the military, like power sharing agreements, and they've already accused leftists and secular people and people who are trying to continue the revolution of attempting to destroy the country. They'll say people are trying to destroy Egypt, and they'll accuse people of being foreign provocateurs, and accuse people of all types of things in the media. They used a couple children that they arrest, either people that they had arrested or other youth, and got them to say on national TV that they were forced to fight in the streets against the military by their families or friends and things like this. And they're trying to paint a picture of Egypt being successful in its revolution and everything being over. And so at the one-year anniversary, I wasn't there for the one-year anniversary of January 25th, but they had huge banners that said, "Let's celebrate the holiday of the revolution and like the of the victory of the revolution. They're very, very much pushing forward this idea that the revolution is over. And this led to some fighting between Muslim Brotherhood people and other people who were more involved in the revolution and more involved from the start and are who are ongoing in their fight for social justice and freedom and dignity for Egyptian people. And it led to a very physical clash because the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to dominate the discourse around the revolution.
So who makes up the more secular and leftist demographics of revolutionaries in Egypt? Like, who are they class-wise, race-wise, gender-wise?
Well, I mean, race-wise, they're Arabs, and it's pretty easy. I mean, there's other people as well that are there, African, like sub-Saharan Africans that have moved up to Egypt. But in terms of who they are, I mean, there's anarchists, communists, socialists, liberals, just plain secularists who are not really politically affiliated, but who don't want a state that's kind of run by the religious parties or like the religion. And there's also, you know, street youth, the people from the slums. There's huge slums all around Cairo, informal housing, and so there's millions of people in Cairo that literally live on, you know, under $2 a day. It's these people. I mean, I saw a lot of street youth that were there. The ultras are one of the most interesting elements within the, I guess, the more radical and leftist segments of the revolution. I mean, they're the ones who have been on the front lines of clashes since the start of the revolution, and who are still fighting the police and still fighting the military, and who could still successfully do that and get people into the streets to successfully push back and gain space.
Do you find there's a difference in who supports the leftists and who supports, say, the Muslim Brotherhood strategy and party?
It's interesting. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood has a lot of deep roots in a lot of areas. And so they have a lot of, they've been providing social services in a lot of senses to a lot of people. And so there's a lot of loyalty there to the Muslim Brotherhood based on that in certain areas. But they also have a different class for the most part. They're also of a wealthier class than average Egyptians. And there is also a resentment because they do also have a lot of, like, you know, private services and schools and things like this that people aren't allowed, like, can't afford to participate in a lot of places. And so I think that some people might see the Muslim Brotherhood as a positive thing for Egypt, as a change, but that'll only be until they realize that they have the same economic policies. And that's the main thing, is that they've assured the world that they're not going to change Mubarak's economic policies. And also they're very much, you know, in a power-sharing agreement with the military, and they're not trying to bring the military to account for any of the crimes against the people. And so, you know, just like the military, and they have had, you know, a decent reputation, and, you know, had some pretty generalized sympathy and generalized affinity, but I think as they are the new power, things are going to shift. And they're already starting to shift, as we've seen.
What type of new institutions or alternative institutions were created during the revolution that people in the left and secularist and anarchist communities are really trying to popularize and have people build allegiances to instead of the state?
I think this is really where the revolution actually is. I mean, that's the one thing. A lot of people seem to think that the revolution was a failure because it led to the Muslim Brotherhood getting into power, into this democracy bullshit. What I really see as the revolution has been the process of dismantling, you know, state monopoly of unions, for example. There's been a huge surge in independent trade unions, and there's been the first independent trade union federation formed. And that's a huge development. And then there's also independent media emerging and becoming very popular in Egypt. There's also groups like the Ultras that have surged in popularity. It's very organized squatting and housing takeovers. And so like there's these really interesting things happening on the ground that are very inspiring to see, that are very revolutionary and very very much makes the revolution worthwhile. It's not the elections. It's bigger than that.
Could you describe for me how the squatting is a bit more organized?
Okay, so huge parts of Cairo were informally developed. I mean, just through negotiating between different plot owners and different people in the community, kind of self-organizing how their community should be kind of developed. So that's really interesting, and also led to a lot of informal housing and squatting in lands around Cairo that was tolerated. When you have millions of people that can't afford to rent a place or buy a place, it's just something that governments generally have to tolerate, is that people squat in shanty towns and slums on the outskirts of urban centers. What has changed is that people have kind of got organized and have recently been involved in some pretty high-profile housing takeovers in more affluent neighborhoods of Cairo. One of the most impressive, which I linked to my my report, a simultaneous takeover of over 2,000 units in October 6th city or October 26th city. It's a city named after a day in October. Mostly upper middle class. There's like a pretty high-end university there. There was a pretty huge housing development that was squatted, all the units kind of occupied, and defended against the military, defended against the police from coming in. They brought in technicians and hooked up water and power. And they also set up informal public transit, tuk-tuk terminals. Those are kind of like decentralized mass transit systems. There's like this organization happening. It's across the country. Communities mobilized around the revolution, and a lot of those networks have managed to continue way past the revolution. And so there's still community assemblies, neighborhood assemblies. These links that were made in the battles in the streets are still ongoing links that people will call each other when they need each other for help, instead of calling the police.
Did you attend any neighborhood assemblies?
I didn't get a chance to attend any of the neighborhood assemblies. I talked to a couple of people who were speaking about them, but when we were there, I mean, we were mostly there for the 5 days of clashes, and then 5 days before that also, but more hanging out with independent media makers and talking to people who had been there for a while and could give us a broader understanding as to like what's been happening on the ground post Mubarak. And so that's where we focused our efforts, and also talking to ultras and anarchists.
Can you describe for the listeners some of the alternatives to police that were operating when you were there?
Police are still universally despised. People self-organize outside of policing. Police are pretty much there only to, and it's pretty widely recognized that police are not there to serve anyone or protect anyone but the state. And so people during the revolution, and it's an ongoing revolution, but during the most intense periods of January 2011, started their own neighborhood defense networks and set up blockades and armed themselves and made sure that the police and other para-state types wouldn't come in and loot and destroy their neighborhoods. And I mean, it was very clear that they were doing that. The police disappeared from the streets after they were beat, after they lost control. They pretty much disappeared, and what that meant is they took off their uniforms and started causing a lot of problems by going into neighborhoods and being violent, going into neighborhoods and, you know, stealing things and destroying people's houses. And so people had to defend themselves from that. They also released people from prisons on the condition that they would go and attack the protesters. And so there was a lot of elements that needed to be defended from. And so neighborhoods all across Egypt found ways to defend themselves, which is really interesting.
Can you describe any of the setups that you heard about how they organized those defenses?
Well, most of what I heard was that there was like blockades and kind of like checkpoints to make sure that people that were coming in weren't police or had like good reason to be coming through their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So blockades, people armed themselves with whatever they got, whatever they could get. Like some people had weapons, some people had, you know, crude things like bats and Molotovs. And so, and it was people from all classes, all genders, pretty much everyone kind of organized their own defense for their own neighborhoods and took turns at the barricades.
So describe a bit more of independent media popping up in Egypt, since that was one of the groups you're hanging out with.
Okay. Yeah. So like there's some really good people making a lot of videos called Mosareen. I would definitely recommend to check their stuff out if you can speak Arabic, because sadly there's not much subtitles on their videos. But they become the second most popular YouTube channel in Egypt, and that's pretty huge because their stuff is very, very much against the military and against the ongoing abuses of power and for you know, feminist, secularist, anarchist, generally like revolutionary ideas. There's also a lot of great independent media that's been happening from outside. I mean, people from, you know, Europe and North America have been paying a lot of attention to it and going there and connecting with people and doing great reports. And then there's also just like street media, like people doing weed pasting and graffiti. Before Mubarak was in power, graffiti was really hard. I mean, it wouldn't stay up that long. Graffiti would get taken down pretty quickly. Post Mubarak, the streets are filled with graffiti. Mm-hmm. And that's because the police and the state security apparatus is so overwhelmed that there's no resources to allocate towards taking down graffiti. One of the biggest pushes for street art and graffiti was the ultras, popularizing anti-police slogans and popularizing resistance through graffiti and graffiti culture in general sprang up through that and really exploded through that. And so now that's a huge way that people communicate. And then also just people print their own little pamphlets and stuff and hand them out on the streets. So a lot of things that I saw during the uprising against the military was people just standing in the middle of streets, just giving out flyers to like every single car that drove by them. And so it was just kind of like self-organized media distribution is happening quite frequently. Anarchists have also started like to have assemblies, mm-hmm. and have some translation projects. And there's a really great anarchist journalist that I got the chance to hang out with quite a bit when I was there called Jano Charbel. And he works for Egypt Independent, which is an independent newspaper in Egypt. But he's done some really great reports on revolutionary stuff out there too. So there's a lot going on in regards to independent media. But the thing is that the state still has quite a huge monopoly on broadcast media. So anything like radio and TV is quite heavily controlled by the state. Even starting up like a pirate radio station can land you in prison for up to 15 years. And that happened to someone that wasn't even broadcasting anything revolutionary, just music that he liked. They threw him in jail for 15 years for illegal broadcasting. So broadcasting is definitely a huge monopoly of the state that still needs to be broken. But, you know, other forms of media are flourishing.
It seems like in a lot of what you said, the ultra groups played a really decisive role in a lot of what was going on before you got there and when you got there. So could you describe for the listeners who the ultras are and what they do and how they're organized?
Okay, so the ultras are, you know, also known as football hooligans by most of the Western world. They're extreme football fans, and I'm talking about football in the global sense, not the American sense of American football.
What you might call
soccer. it's basically organized around football. It's youth and football fans in general who are against the commercialization of sport, who fight the police and live their lives in conflict with authority, and who basically organize their affinity groups around like their favorite sports teams and become very dedicated fans for their sports teams. And so in Egypt, it's fairly new, only about 6 years old. But it's kind of seen an explosion with popularity as the sport becomes more commercialized and ticket sales get more expensive. There's growing resentment, and then the police serve the role of containing people at the stadiums and kicking people out, and so this natural beef evolved. And what's really interesting is that they were already kind of political before the revolution, but people didn't think they were political. Like the average Egyptian would say that they were just hooligans who like to fight police, and they were just like apolitical in their actions. They just like football and like fighting the police. But one of the biggest critiques they had of the police through their graffiti and also in their chants in the stadiums and in some of their banners was the state security and the police's role in keeping the blockade on Gaza, and also siding with Israel and having these friendly relations with Israel while there's a ethnic cleansing and process of what they see as their brothers and sisters in Gaza and in the West Bank. And so calling them collaborators and stuff like this was a big deal. And so when the revolutions really started kicking off, inspired by the Tunisian uprisings, a lot of people weren't ready to fight the police, and a lot of people weren't ready for that kind of violence. But the ultras were. They had already been fighting the police in the stands, in the stadiums, and in the streets for years, and had developed tactics and techniques on effective ways of fighting them. And so, what you see is that they broke up the January 25th gathering in Tahrir Square. Then there was dispersed street clashes for the next few days, and then the ultras were really the groups who kind of led the charge on February 28th, which was the day of rage. On January 28th, which was the day of rage, in taking back Tahrir Square and physically and violently pushing the police back to the point where they could not disperse the crowds and they could not control the situation. And so it wasn't just the ultras, obviously, that did it, but they kind of formed a front line and used their experience fighting the police to actually allow for these mass demonstrations to happen, because otherwise they would have just been dispersed with violence immediately. And so they also stayed at Tahrir Square every time that the threat of a state crackdown was made clear by state media and by Mubarak. When Mubarak would threaten to violently evict everyone, they would stay, and they would actually call on all their supporters and everyone to come. And they're actually quite a huge social force. I mean, it's some people would like to dismiss them as as just hooligans or this fringe group, but they're probably one of the most powerful social forces in Egypt today. They have tens of thousands of active members in one group of ultras, because each group of ultras is for its own team. So for example, for the ultras White Knights or the ultras Al-Alwi, those two groups, those two teams have tens of thousands of active members, and many of them actively identify as anarchists. The groups themselves don't belong on the political spectrum, and they make themselves quite clear, like as groups, they're not on the political spectrum whatsoever. But if you talk to individual ultras, including many of the founders, there's a very very public claim to anarchism and anarchist ideas that that they promote, and a lot of their graffiti has Circle A's and is anarchistic and has anarchist messages, and so that also reflects in the way they organize. They organize in a non-hierarchical fashion. You know, it's through forums, online forums, and through kind of collective process. And their main thing is living in conflict with the state and with police, and being against the commercialization of sports. So when you look at like what they stand for and how they organize and what they're all about, it's quite clearly an anti-authoritarian current, and encompassing quite a large number of anarchist individuals in Egypt.
That poses really interesting questions for what could be done with sports fans in Canada around hockey or soccer. I mean, it could be divided into years. You could be like, I support Toronto. Just depends on what season it is.
Well, I mean, that's something that was really interesting, because for a lot of people on the left here, we were very quick to dismiss the riots in Vancouver after the Stanley Cup loss as, apolitical hooliganism, and just kind of denouncing it, and this is probably a strategic error. I mean, in Egypt, people did the same thing, but now the majority of people that are still interested in revolution and still interested in bettering their lives and interested in changing the system are quite fond of the ultras and quite happy for their presence at demos, because they give teeth to the demos. They come to the demos with fireworks, they come with Molotovs, with flares, with chants that really rile people up, with songs. They've very much popularized. They have popular chants and songs that have been adopted by the broader movement that they started in the stadiums. And so, I think radicalization around sports is definitely a potential in Canada. Maybe Vancouver would be the most potential for that kind of activity. But when you see it, when you see North America, sports is generally where that energy kind of boils over and turns into a riot, or whatever you want to call it. It's over like the winning or the losing of a sports match. And I mean, that's kind of sad in a sense, but it's not really the winning or losing of the sports match that really enables people or encourages or inspires people to do what they do. People do what they do for a wide range of very complex social and economic reasons. There is definitely political undertones to what happened in Vancouver. So maybe ultras could emerge in Canada, but I don't think it would be around football. There's just not a big enough scene. It's not the most popular sport. I mean, for the rest of the world, football is the most popular sport, but here it's hockey. So maybe the hockey ultras might be something we'll see in the future. Who knows?
I think the one like leading question that moves from like the personal experiences of Egypt into more ideological questions is again this question of nonviolence versus violence, and how people like keep trying to pretend the Arab Spring was a nonviolent uprising.
I think it's really interesting because I was in Greece before Egypt, and people like to talk about the violent protests in Greece, right? That's in the news a lot. And so I was there, and I witnessed some of these demonstrations. That was so mild compared to Egypt. When we got to Egypt, the demonstrations took a way further in terms of violence. I mean, it's not nonviolent to be in a clash with the military where you're exchanging projectiles and people die. I mean, the Arab Spring was never nonviolent. No country within the uprisings had a purely nonviolent movement. And I'd like to argue that there's been no movement in history that's been purely nonviolent that has actually successfully done anything. The civil rights movement had people that were doing more militant things. So did the, you know, movements in India. It wasn't just Gandhi's movement. You know, there was other people that were doing much more violent things than what we see today in Egypt, including assassinations. And so I know it's really appealing for people to try and think that this was a totally nonviolent uprising, but it's just not true. And also, it's kind of funny because ideas of violence change when context change and when situations and geography changes. One of the best quotes I think that I heard was when someone asked one of the revolutionary youth about the uprisings in Egypt, if they were nonviolent. He said, "Yeah, they're nonviolent. We're only throwing rocks. No one's taken up guns or arms yet." And I think that's a really interesting kind of line to draw, because people here wouldn't draw that line at the same place in terms of what's violent. It's not violent once you pick up guns here for people.
People here get mad at me if I like swear at the cops because you're being too confrontational and it wrecks our credibility.
And that's the most disempowering and delusional way to organize. I mean, anti-police is probably the most popular thing you can get in North America in terms of a social movement. You know, one of the most popular songs in pop culture history is Fuck the Police. If you talk to anyone, you know, in the lower class, it's very clearly a disdain for police. And I really don't know that many people personally that I've spoken to. And I speak to a lot of people that actually would disagree with, you know, being confrontational with police or, you know, like saying things like F the police. Like, the police are quite clearly the line of defense for the state to protect itself and its interests, and for those who have money to protect themselves and their interests against everyone else. It's very clear to most people. And I think that if you want to build a popular movement, you have to include like an anti-police statement. I mean, for Egypt, it was very clearly an anti-police demonstration. They did it on National Police Day, and they fought the police. Leading up to it, there was, you know, this huge graffiti campaign the ultras put on, ACAB, calling all cops bastards. All cops are bastards, and so we shouldn't shy away from being confrontational with those who are on the front lines of enforcing oppression and enforcing exploitation. I think that's ridiculous, and it does us. We totally lose credibility when we want to pander to our oppressors or to those in power. Pandering to those in power isn't going to win us any sympathy or any affinity from those that we want to work with. So let's just call it what it is.
I mean, my usual response at the end of the day is like, I haven't seen a progressive force of the police take over the police department and make it into a progressive force. So,
yeah, I mean, and I think it's almost impossible. Like, police are actually there, like, to protect property. That's all they've ever been there for. I mean, whether it was, you know, capturing slaves that had escaped and bringing them back to their slave masters, or breaking unions, or, you know, serving in like colonial forces of taking over land for kings and queens. I mean, this is what the police do. This is what they've always done. And today they're there protecting, you know, banks and corporate interests against anyone who wants to change the way that they operate in this world. And so, I mean, the police can never be our friends. I don't think it's possible.
I want to thank you for coming on the show today and letting us know about Egypt, and also bringing some of the ideas back home.
Cool. Thanks for having me.